Hello and welcome to another episode of Hanks a Lot, the comprehensive and encyclopedic podcast examining in chronological order the many films of Mr. Tom Hanks. I am Kent Shelton, your host from beautiful Spokane, Washington, here at Cliffside Studios. And joining me from Hollywood, California, is our resident film critic, Mr. Trace Oakley. And from the wet streets of Seattle, Washington, is our own Quincy Jones, the Mr. Kevin Dennis, our musical director. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the big show.
I feel like an honorary
resident of the Pacific Northwest because we've had a lot of wet streets here.
I see. Yeah, you guys, has it been the rainiest year in California history or something?
I think it's been the rainiest year in world history.
I read the other day that Mammoth Mountain in California, the ski area there, has gotten 665 inches of snow, and a little bit of simple division showed me that's 52 feet of snow over this winter. That's too much snow. That's
Donner Party snow.
Yeah, that's bullshit. Anyway, we are here as always to offer fellowship and love to you, our listeners, and to talk about a Tom Hanks movie. And this week, it's getting dark in Tom Hanks's life. This week, we're going to look at Nothing in Common. It is a film from 1986 starring Tom Hanks, and it's the last screen performance by Jackie Gleason. Tom Hanks, he plays a young go-getter at an ad agency. His father is a real pain in the ass and has recently separated from his mother and intrudes into his life as only Jackie Gleason can. Only this time, he doesn't even have a Diablo chicken sandwich to make us laugh like he had in Smokey and the Bandit. We're going to go to our film critic, Mr. Trace Oakley, and Trace is going to give us some insightful comments about Nothing in Common. Take it away.
And before we continue, let's give a small homage to Trace's hair, which is magnificent. And his reading will, I'm sure, espouse the feelings that are coming through with me by noticing that magnificent coif that he has.
Is it too late for us to put this on YouTube?
Yeah, we'll include hand-drawn illustrations on our
website. Oh, yes, let's do that.
All right, Trace, take it away.
There's a moment about halfway through 1986 is Nothing in Common where we see just how morally bankrupt this movie is. First comes a scene where the Tom Hanks character, David Basner, and his ad agency minions act out the ad campaign they've devised for a powerful airline CEO. Basner has completely half-assed the whole job, and the presentation reflects that. Casting of the associates seemed to have no criteria other than being even more smug than Hanks, perhaps as a half-assed attempt to make the lead character look human. Presentation over, the impossible-to-please head honcho looks stern and stoic, till he suddenly breaks into a megawatt smile. The scene is followed by Jackie Gleason's character, a Cliff Notes Willie Loman, who sells children's clothes, being fired in front of everyone at a junior fashion pageant. The justification? This is the 80s. And being cruel is sometimes necessary in the business world. Cruel and, you know, kind of fun. Set in the 1980s world of advertising, Hanks' character, the newly promoted creative director, is a constant cut-up. The kind of guy who would lace your sandwich with anthrax and then be like, it was just a prank, why so serious? Playing Basner, Hanks carries drumsticks wherever he goes, in lieu of having a character. And Basner carries drumsticks in lieu of having a soul. He beds every girl in sight and shoots hoops in a dugout at a local bar while making sure said activities don't cut into his being a relentlessly annoying prick time. He has aging parents, a meek and repressed mom, and a gruff salesman dad with whom he has nothing in common. Note that nothing can also suggest empty and common can mean ordinary, predictable, and unremarkable. Mom leaves dad and dad gets fired and has some health issues, so enter prodigal son David, help mom move and become caretaker to dad. This really cuts into David's busy schedule of making fun of anyone with a care in the world, dismissing anyone who doesn't listen to cool music, and being a relentlessly annoying prick. He also has a new account, Colonial Airlines, owned by a hard-nosed, straight-shooting, bootstraps, elbow-greased, by-the-numbers top executive, played by veteran character actor Barry Corbin. Captain Tough Guy has a corporate bigwig daughter, who is severe, angular, and attractive, in a the-corporation's-bylaws-require-that-you-think-I'm-hot kind of way. She's also proud of having no sense of humor. She apparently can also fog a mirror, because Hank's character immediately has sex with her. There's another love interest, but sometime gal pal, who does experimental theater. She's played by Bess Armstrong. In a movie with a soul, this character might serve as some sort of moral compass, writing the protagonist towards some hint of humanity. In this movie, she seems to serve no purpose other than someone for Hanks to make fun of, and probably fuck. Dad dances all night at an empty jazz dive and then reveals his rotted foot to his son. He's rushed to the hospital and may lose his life, a leg, two legs, a foot and a half, give or take. He ends up just losing a few toes, while most who worked on the film and all who watched it lose their dignity. Hanks wheels Dad around and suddenly has become a better person. Cue sappy generic title song sung by Christopher Cross. This is a truly wretched movie. Every second is predictable and uninspired. Rather than attempting genuine emotion or humanity, it goes for stale sentimentality and even fails at that. Director Gary Marshall, then best known for Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley, was a funny guy who knew comedy backwards and forwards. His work here is awful. The film starts with a sight gag on an airplane that seems like something Marshall had wanted to do with the Fonz, but couldn't get past the network censors. Here it is an unfunny start to a movie that fails to deliver laughs, smiles, tears, or warmth. Hanks is just unbearable here. Not funny, not interesting, not convincing. When trying to be funny, he's just grating, and then he phones in the tenderness. This was, sadly, Gleason's last role. He was himself ill with cancer at the time of shooting and would die about a year later. He's not bad, especially given the atrocious script he's saddled with. But you watch him and think of what he could have done, even not at full strength, with a strong script, a dimensional character, and a better actor playing his son. Eva Marie Saint, another great talent who, like Gleason, didn't make a lot of films, is luminous as the meek mom who summons the courage to strike out on her own. She manages to be truly heartbreaking in a scene with Hanks, a feat given the void she's playing opposite. Eva Marie Saint is still with us at 98, and she's always a joy to watch, even in a horrible film. Another delightful actress, Bess Armstrong, plays the theater director. It's a completely unnecessary character, but Armstrong is as beautiful, charming, and interesting as always, just this time in an unnecessary movie. Cella Ward plays the corporate siren. Her costumes do most of her acting, but on a film where a diseased foot gives the third best performance, the grading curve is tricky. Hector Elizondo, a Gary Marshall regular, plays the agency head who spends most of his time searching for a toupee that will stay on. As with Corbin, a usually solid actor, Elizondo is given nothing to work with. Both give adequate performances in a movie that's miles from adequate. Dan Castellaneta, a year or two from Homer Simpson fame, plays a member of Hank's creative team. We also see Conrad Janis fronting his real-life jazz band in the scene with the foot. Nothing in Common really has zero to recommend it. The trailer or even a newspaper blurb will tell you all you need to know about what happens. Sitting through it is a truly depressing experience. My score? 1 inch, or 1/12 of a diseased foot.
There you go. We didn't like it very much, huh, Trace?
Other than what I just said, it was great.
All right, yeah. It seems like you may have had some problems with it, and I'll tell you, you are not alone. I was mostly completely confused by this movie because I imagined some people coming into Gary Marshall's office and pitching the idea like, all right, it's Death of a Salesman, but it's a romantic comedy. What do you think? Because it just goes back and forth from scene to scene for being this light comedy. It's basically an episode of Joni Loves Chachi to being this incredible tragic story of this guy who has had a punishing loveless marriage where he ignored and abused his wife for 36 years and now is at the end of his life with no job, no prospects, no way to use his charms, and with a foot that looks like something, it looks like Dustin Hoffman's foot in Papillon. It's horrifying. And I didn't find the Tom Hanks's his motivation to become a better guy and a better son. I didn't understand why he made the decision, and I don't feel like he earns anything. He became
a better person because of that Christopher Cross song.
Yeah, I think I will say I thought that Jackie Gleason's performance was strong. I thought he was completely believable, and I think it takes a lot of temerity and a lot of guts to play a completely unlikable, unredeemable character. I mean, the scene where he sits with his son and complains about how even on her wedding night, their mom laid there like a rag doll. It's just so uncomfortable. And so it takes a lot of nerve to play that lousy of a human being and still sort of strut around like he's right.
I think you're correct in what you're saying, but I think Hank's character is an even worse person.
Well,
I really do.
He certainly, I don't know if he's a worse person. He's certainly a man child and certainly irritating and annoying. I will say that Tom Hanks was early in his career getting pigeonholed into these roles that only Michael Keaton could pull off. The wacky guy who won't stop joking and these sort of Bill Blazowski, Mr. Mom type characters that they were casting him as. And he didn't do it very well. He always comes off a lot more of a prig than I think he means to. Kevin, had you ever seen this movie before?
Yes, several times.
Are you a fan?
No, I didn't ever care for the movie. There was a few moments that I thought were really good. I agree that Jackie Gleason generally did a really good job of it, and his was the most believable character of the whole movie. The one that you most identified with as real. Everybody else did seem like a caricature to me or overdone. Generally speaking, the mom did a good job too. I forgot Yves Saint Laurent. Yeah, she was great. Tom Hanks is. Since we're doing a Tom Hanks podcast, the two parts that I thought were important, at least for me, and again, there wasn't a lot funny in this movie. They tried, the disappointing part to me was when they kept trying to make that secretary laugh, you know, and that was the big thing, was they were always trying to mess with her and it never kind of worked. And then at the end, it still didn't work. It was never funny. She never, that was sad.
It was workplace harassment.
It was more like harassment.
Put that in the closing credits.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It was just
didn't work. But the other part that I was moved by, I remember this time I watched it, I felt very flat. When I watched it this time, I felt emotionally completely flat. Back when I watched it originally, I remember the two scenes that were powerful to me were when Tom is telling the big advertising boss, no matter what you say, I'm not going to New York with you, or I'm going to see my dad I'm going to be with him for surgery. That scene where he absolutely chooses to go for his father, when I first saw the movie, was powerful to me. This time I thought that he still did a good job with that, but I agree with you. It feels like a Michael Keaton steal. And then the last part, the only other part that I thought was really powerful to me, was the last line in the movie where Jackie Gleason says, "You're the last person in the world I thought would come through for me." That moment was powerful for me, and the rest of the movie was just in the garbage can. I agree.
Yeah, I thought when he said that last line, I kind of thought that they came up with that first and sort of reverse engineered a whole movie.
Yep.
Yeah,
off,
I agree.
Off of that line, off of the cigar chomping, hard drinking son, dad who always berated and belittled his wussy, nerdy son, and then ends up coming home from the hospital and saying that line. And I think they kind of worked the whole movie backwards from there.
And that was so cliche, but I thought that was so well done. And even this time when I watched it, that little moment, and it was all Jackie Gleason.
Oh, yeah. Jackie Gleason, I thought his best performance was when he's in the hospital and his ex-wife comes to visit him. Mm. And she really pours her heart out and says, like, we had all these troubles because we never talked and everything, but I always cared about you and I still care about you. And he says, BS. Yeah. And she leaves the room like trying not to cry.
And then he cries.
And then he, once he's laying there all by himself, he cries for himself, not for hurting her, but he cries for himself. I don't know. It's,
that was very powerful and very wild. Well acted.
Yeah. A wildly, disappointing movie though.
I agree.
I almost want to blame the city of Chicago. Every time a movie is set in Chicago, it acts like it's funnier than it is, and it tries to be more serious than it.
What's another example you would say?
About Last Night with Rob Lowe and Demi Moore, another movie where Chicago is a main character in it. It acts like it's the most hilarious movie in the world. It also acts like there's these huge emotional stakes we should care about. And I guarantee you, the minute you're done watching About Last Night, you'll have no idea what you've done for the previous 2 hours.
I've never seen it.
One of the most successful movies you can think of that's like, that really has Chicago as a main character in it is Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which we all loved when we were 15 or 16 or something, but then if you've watched it anytime after your 25th birthday, you've said he's a sociopath. Ferris Bueller is a horrible person. He's
master manipulator.
He completely has used his psychopathy to completely ruin the lives of his friends, and he has no shame, absolutely no. And all he has to say about it is like, yeah, well, you know, life goes by pretty fast. You gotta stop and check it out. Yeah, I just totaled my friend's dad's $1 million Ferrari and completely ruined their relationship. But hey, time for me to climb over some backyard fences and jump on some trampolines. It's that movie is infuriating if you watch it as an adult.
Hanks is not in.
I blame Chicago. Also, this is a Chicago thing. I think
you mentioned something about, you know, kind of raising the stakes. And one thing I noticed with Nothing in Common is that, Gleason seems old to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tom Hanks' character seems to be about 28. They refer to him having moved out of the house 10 years ago. Gleason seems a little old to be his father, but moreover, when he loses his job, it's kind of like, well, you know, he's had this job forever. You know, he can probably retire. They briefly allude to him being a gambler, but then they say, you know, his gambling debts are like $75. So there's just sort of no stakes, really.
Well, I obviously think it was written for a younger actor because they've been married 36 years. Which is, I guess, we're supposed to imagine that maybe Tom Hanks is 32 or 33 or something like that. They got married and then had an only child a few years later. I also think that, you know, there's no mention that, well, yeah, you've lost your job, but you could start drawing Social Security. You need to go on a fixed income. There's no indication that he's 65 even, or that he's of retirement age, which Jackie Gleason certainly looks like he is.
You guys talked about, A Money Pit and one of our other movies that we talked about, you both mentioned how badly written and directed it was. And see, to me, this movie was glaringly badly written and directed. What are your guys' thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think the writing was terribly amateurish. And when you look at Gary Marshall's, you know, the movies he's made since. I mean, this guy's made like The Princess Bride and Pretty Woman. Yeah. He's made some movies that have really worked, whether you like them or not. They really, they've got tight screenplays that work and appeal to the public. And I don't know what happened here, other than it was, I believe it was written by committee. And I think that committee looked like the idiots in the ad agency pitch meeting, where they're all, you know, where they're more concerned with throwing paper airplanes at each other than they are with making a good product, which seems to be what Gary Marshall understands the advertising world to be. A lot of people with squirt guns wearing funny hats or something. I didn't hate Hector Elizondo, but he was wasted. I am very curious, because when I looked up this movie on IMDb, they mentioned that Hector Elizondo is related to Gary Marshall. Now, I know he's in a lot of his movies, but I cannot figure out how they're related.
I think you mentioned it, the drug use.
Yeah.
His dealer, perhaps.
No, but the director and the guy who's the head of the ad agency, Tom Hanks' boss, apparently the director and that actor are somehow related. I did want to mention one other thing, and that's that I think this ad agency made the worst commercials ever. I think that their idea for that airline commercial is terrible. The other commercial they showed them shooting, where it was a lot of people walking around in fog and rubbing perfume on each other's faces, didn't make any sense. I really just want to see a reel of this company's commercials, because I think they suck.
But that would probably be more entertaining than the movie.
Oh yeah, probably.
Yeah.
More product.
I do want to mention, I have a little bit of a personal connection to this movie. I was actually, when I was a kid, was in a movie with Conrad Janis. Conrad Janis, veteran character actor, who appears late in the movie with his actual jazz band.
Yeah, his jazz band, the unlisted jazz band. He's
now the interesting thing about this, and I don't know exactly the story here, but I suspect I know. There was a band around this time, also a jazz band, called the Beverly Hills Unlisted Jazz Band, which was fronted by George Segal. And this was at a time when Segal's career was kind of a little bit on the skids before he made a comeback in television.
Huh.
And he played the banjo and sang, and I think Conrad Janis was part of it. And I know this because my dad, who had a jazz festival in the 70s and 80s, actually was trying to book them for his jazz band. But I'm thinking that maybe in this case, they figured George Segal being the front man of the jazz band would be a little too distracting.
Yeah, definitely would be.
Yeah, you know, I managed to upstage the diseased foot. So they kind of made Conrad Janis the front man and just called it the Unlisted Jazz Band.
But
I was in the movie Duchess and the Dirtwater Fox when I was a kid, and Conrad Janis was one of the stars of that.
Yeah, and eagle-eyed fans of Gary Marshall TV shows will recognize Conrad Janis as the owner of the music store where Mindy works, on Mork and Mindy. Yeah, I think his name was Conrad on the show, in that sort of Mary Tyler Moore tradition of just giving them the same first name so they don't have to learn a character name. I will say this movie received absolutely no Academy Award nominations and no Academy Awards, although it should have been considered for special makeup effects for that foot. That shocking like 2 seconds of looking at Jackie Gleason's foot is the only thing I remember from this movie, from watching it originally. Just like, oh yeah, it's a horror movie. It's just about a guy with a gross foot. It was a really super gross foot, and they should have found a way around showing it somehow. It's very upsetting.
I like that. I thought that was really important. Again, that was part of what I remember about it, was that it was such a shift from
shot.
Yeah, because that was important, because we were like, this guy's a jerk. He's you know, there was nothing about the Gleason character that was really likable, and that gave you some sympathy for him because it was so big And I thought that was important. So
it did. It showed that no matter how big a jerk he was, that he in fact did have, as they say, feet of clay. Because
well, he was really, really rotted clay.
He was human after all. And I know that I know that Kevin's going to talk a bit about the music. This is a movie that had a lot of '80s music in it.
I'm not going to talk much.
A lot of well-known '80s bands, but I do know that the soundtrack was composed by Patrick Leonard? Who is the composer of the soundtrack?
Leonard.
Patrick Leonard, who he was a very, very big songwriter and producer in the '80s and '90s, most well known for writing and producing a lot of Madonna's biggest hits, and then later going on to work with Bon Jovi on some of their biggest hits. He was married to the actress Olivia Diabo for several years.
Ooh.
And really, really punching above his weight there. And and when they got divorced, part of her divorce settlement is that she got something like $300,000 a month of maintenance, and she got 50% of all of his Bon Jovi money, all the money coming in from his song publishing and song ownership.
A lot of money.
So she was married to him for like 8 or 9 years and would really never have to work again once they divorced. It was, even at the time, it was a divorce settlement that like made TMZ and all the papers are like, oh my God, Olivia Diabo struck gold in divorcing her her weird ponytailed music producer husband.
For listeners who don't know, Olivia Diabo, best known as the hot teen daughter on The Wonder Years.
Yes. Yeah.
And yeah. You hear the divorce story, you can hear the Daniel Stern voiceover.
Right. I'll never forget the summer my dad got divorced.
I'll never forget those $300 a month checks that came in.
$300,000 a month checks. All right. Well, what can you say about the music, if anything? Was there anything that stood out?
No. From the movie standpoint, no. Just as a background of interest, there's a lot of people that were famous that were involved in music. I mean, Aretha Franklin was Until You Say You Love Me. There was Richard Marx.
The Thompson Twins.
Thompson Twins did the main song. The Kinks were in there. Carly Simon performed If It Wasn't Love, written by Patrick Leonard and all that. So, but really, I mean, music and sound, you know, is supposed to add and be another character in the film. And I found nothing in this film that the music added a character to. It was all just what Hollywood needed to put some music in. And at least for my opinion, I found it of no character. There's so many times I'm looking forward to so many other movies that we're going to do with Tom Hanks where the music is so cool and fun to talk about. And let's not waste time with this one. I don't think it was of any value at all.
I thought the only sort of like musical signature in the whole thing was that Jackie Gleason's character seems to listen to nothing but like Dixieland jazz. And so whenever Tom Hanks would go to his apartment, you would just hear this peeling.
And even then,
like the most generic Dixieland jazz.
We got an old guy who likes Dixieland jazz. Oh, something interesting for a movie.
I thought
that was trash. And there was nothing in the Dixieland jazz music that was interesting either. It was standard basic.
Go out of their way to make it just only horns and just really on a chalkboard.
But what I thought was the worst bit of like screenwriting in the movie was where Tom Hanks, who apparently grew up in a house with this man and was subjected to this at top volume for his entire life, he says to him like, "Hey, why don't we go out and you know, we'll go out tonight. We'll listen to that music you like. What is it called? Jazz? Like, Like this is something his dad just got into 3 weeks ago.
It was just riding there. I mean, it was just there's no way around it. And so that's why I don't even want to talk about it, because I'm like, you know, it's music is so important, and it so makes or breaks a movie. And it can. And this particular movie, it had no voice at all. There was no value to the music that was put in. We could have changed the entire choices of music, and it would have made zero difference. Like his dad could have been just as interested in polka music or even heavy metal.
I think,
it would have been
New York underground post-punk no wave music. I think he could have listened to just all,
and it would have not changed the movie at all.
Right. But it's really saying something that a movie that has a lot of music in it and the music just really doesn't add anything, doesn't change anything, doesn't have any impact.
Right. No. I think that's very telling. And it's very much like your review and what we've all kind of talked about. There's so much of this movie that just was just white noise.
Well, I really do think that we're going to see a shift coming up in the next movie or two, where what Hollywood wanted from Tom Hanks in these early leading roles was for him to be superficially glib, as all of these scenes where he's just giving glib throwaway. It's a whole performance based on being not taking anything seriously. What I think was supposed to be a big laugh line is when he asks Barry Corbin if he eats soup with his fork, and then Barry Corbin laughs like it's hilarious. And it's just
I don't even remember that line.
Oh, he says, like, sometimes I eat my whole meal with my salad fork, and he was like, does that include the soup? And it's like, that's not funny. And if I was sitting down at a business meeting with somebody I was trying to woo, that's the stupidest thing I could possibly say. It's not funny. And
what
it's
else
dumb.
Can we talk about? Right. How about the weather in California? Because this movie
is certainly,
What else we got?
I always love Bess Armstrong, and you know, even in the movie where her character, there's absolutely no reason for her to be there, still just a charming, wonderful, beautiful actress. Always enjoy seeing her. So that was
I think one of the most believable performances in the movie is when she takes a broom and tries to swat Tom Hanks out of her apartment because he's so annoying. I believe that she was angry and upset and wanted him to get the hell out of her apartment.
Now that's something to build a movie around.
Yeah, she's trying to canoodle with her boyfriend, and her old high school friend is dropping by drunk and unannounced and wearing Ray-Ban Clubmaster sunglasses at night, which you shouldn't do. And so she tries to hit him with a broom. And I felt like there were human beings in the movie for a minute.
I agree.
All right. That's true. Yeah. All right. Well, this movie.
I hate to agree with you guys.
This movie wanted to be funny. This movie wanted to be charming. This movie wanted to be important. And we have nothing in common with what this movie was trying to do. We have nothing in common with this film's goals. So that's where we're going to leave it. We'll be back next week with a lesser known, maybe Jim, maybe a poison pill from Tom Hanks's career. It's a movie called Trace. What's that movie called?
Every Time We Say Goodbye.
Every Time We Say Goodbye. Named after a song by it's Elton John or Gershwin or somebody. Cole Porter. Yes. And I think this week because we're looking forward to watching Every Time We Say Goodbye, we'll say goodbye to you, our listeners, and you know, and we'll die a little, and we'll wonder.
This next song you're about to hear will help you with that death.
Yeah, and we're going to leave you, as we always do, with an original composition of music perspired.
This is a euthanasia offering.
This may be a funeral dirge for this movie as we throw soil over the
foot.
The VHS cassette of it.
Ode to the Beast Foot.
Yes. This has been another episode of Hank's a Lot, and we thank you guys a lot for listening. And now we're going to listen to a little bit of music composed by our own Kevin Dennis that sums up his feelings on Nothing in Common. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. And cue that beautiful music.
Oh.
We got nothing in common, just giving away pins. One hates the Jeep, the other hates experimental theater, making jokes with the secretary, then not horsing around with the boss's daughter. Father and daughter tell all to each other. A late divorce brings several breakdowns. Intimate family pains revealed. Falling apart with the old woman and the cat. Trying to get back in with dad. Going out for jazz. No new glasses at 4 a.m. Bad feet to follow. Hospital fit and dad could die. Mom can't help and it's not her fault. Stay with dad instead of going to New York. Losing the deal for dad's surgery. Hands off after the count. She has a sense of humor and will be a good boss. Tom's good boss offers empathy and help. The pins return. Needs sleep so he won't be grumpy for the operation. Spouse reunion coming up now. He still can make her laugh. Gave up on each other. Now they are just roommates. She cares. He refuses. Jackie cries. Surgery cigar. Girlfriend comes back during the wait. Chooses getting to know father over the job. Cries on daddy's belly. Mom can't help and goes. Girlfriend is back with comfort. New clothes and one last pin. Last person I thought would ever come through for me.
This has been another episode of Hanks a Lot, the Tom Hanks podcast, recorded in Spokane, Washington at Cliffside Studios. Your hosts are Kent Shelton, Trace Oakley, and Kevin Dennis. If you've got comments, questions, or your own thoughts about the Tom Hanks filmography, please reach out to us at hankspodcast@gmail.com. That's hankspodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends, bring your sister, and we'll see you next time for Hanks a Lot.